From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Joe Palca. For the rest of this hour, a look at science and politics. Last week, the Fish and Wildlife Service announced that it will review 8 decisions on endangered species made by Julie McDonald. McDonald resigned from the agency in May amid charges that she tampered with the science behind those decisions. Critics say the dust-up at the Fish and Wildlife Service is just the latest example of how the Bush administration has been playing fast and loose with science. The Union of Concerned Scientists is one group that's been particularly vocal in its criticism. They've accused the administration of squelching data about global warming and filling advisory panels with people willing to toe the Republican Party line. But, you know, is the current administration doing anything all that different from previous administrations? Richard Nixon reportedly had an enemies list that included scientists. Bill Clinton is accused of delaying scientific reports on mercury. Well, someone who's watched political administration, Washington administrations come and go and watched the strange way they deal with science or don't, is Dan Greenberg, Daniel Greenberg, actually. He's a science journalist and the author of Science, Money, and Politics, Political Triumph and Ethical Erosion. And, oh, he has a new book coming out, which is called Science for Sale, The Perils, Rewards, and Delusions of Campus Capitalism. That'll be out next month from the University of Chicago Press. And he joins me here in the NPR studios in Washington. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Joe. Glad to be here.
And if you'd like to talk with Dan or me or talk about this topic, give us a call. The number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. So, I mean, I don't know. We don't have to deal specifically with the Fish and Wildlife Service, but is this just another example of an administration that just doesn't care at all about science, or is this business as usual for Washington?
Indeed, it is part of a pattern, but I think if you want to look at the relations of this administration to science, you have to look at two areas, and that's where all the action has taken place and where this administration has been able to offend the scientific community to a degree I've never seen before. One is in anything related to reproductive biology, and that is stem cells, contraception, things of that sort. In cracking down on the area of reproductive biology, the administration is pandering to the evangelical religious fundamentalist right. The other involves matters that concern the business and corporate community. For example, Kyoto Accord would have put heavy financial burden, at least initially, on American industry, and the administration therefore wouldn't go along with that. Global change, anything of that sort. On environmental matters, wetland restrictions, for example, the real estate people don't like that, and the administration kowtows to the real estate industry. So where they have a chance there to go against the science and show these two or three constituencies that were really with you, they do it at the cost of offending the scientific community.
And what is the cost of offending the scientific community? And as the editor of Nature used to say, do they do so at their peril, or is it just who cares?
Well, there's really no too great peril in it, except one thing that really I think is sort of blown up in their face is the stem cell issue. Because that has grabbed the imagination of the American people in terms of expectation of medical miracles. And Nancy Reagan even signed on to that and went against this administration. Generally, these are kind of, you know, back burner issues that the public doesn't pay much attention to and the press doesn't either. But stem cells and medical miracles and NIH and cure of dread disease, prevention and so forth, is an issue that is easily exploited in the imagination of the public. And I think that has happened now. I think that every survey that's been made shows that the public is really quite annoyed, offended, and feels threatened by the administration policies on restricting federal funds for stem cell research.
Hmm. But, you know, I'm thinking back to the Clinton administration, where if you ask scientists today, they'll talk about that as the good old days when people, they were revered. But it was the Clinton administration that pushed through the International Space Station, which scientists, by and large, said this is a terrible waste of money and we don't want anything to do with it. And he doesn't take a hit for that.
Well, man in space has always been an issue with the scientists. The basic scientists in the universities feel that this is coming out of their budget and it really has no scientific value. But there are other constituencies, industry, the imaginative public, and a few others that say we have to have man in space, and the next natural step is the International Space Station, and then Moon and Mars. But you will find generally a continuing thread going back to the early days of the space program that says that we should minimize man in space and put the money into planetary research. So the International Space Station is just a continuation of that old story.
So where does this fish and wildlife story fit into this picture? I mean, is it, again, would you argue a financial interest that might cause an animal to be taken off or put on the endangered species list? I mean, that there were big issues with the stickleback, I think, seem to recall, dozens of years ago, where nuclear generators were being held up.
Spotted owl.
Spotted owl, yes. Well, that was the poster child, wasn't it?
Well, saving endangered species can often entail some kind of economic consequences for various interests, particularly the timbering interests. You can't go into that forest and cut down the trees because the spotted owl will be endangered. So I think that there, once again, this theme comes through of pandering to a particular economic interest that is part of the basic political core.
Okay. We're talking with Dan Greenberg about science and politics and how White House and administrations past and present have modified or accepted the message that scientists have to offer. Our number is 800-989-8255. And let's take a call now from Nathan in Ann Arbor. Nathan, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hi, am I on the air?
Yes, you are. Go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. One of the things that I'm curious about is the fact that scientists are an inherent interest group within this controversy, especially as we think about stem cells and various other matters. And when you think about scientists giving advice to politicians in terms of policy issues, I think it's difficult for us to be able to actually, as much as we want to depoliticize science and perhaps think about the democratization of science, that in fact scientists are an interest group, and the way in which they influence policy actually is directly reflective of the fact that they have a desire for certain elements of science to actually move forward, especially looking at the human embryonic stem cell controversy. So I'm wondering if you could just comment on the fact that when politicians are seeking advice from scientists, how is it possible for us to actually separate the interests that scientists have and being able to actually extricate sort of this democratized position when it comes to policymaking?
Hmm. My observation over many years is that when politicians seek scientific advice, they're not looking for wisdom. They're looking for support for their preconceptions. They know where they want to go. They've made their decision, and they're very happy to have scientists with the proper credentials say, yeah, you're right, that's really what we should do. They don't go in there with a blank saying, oh, this is the problem. Can you guys please suggest some kind of answer for it?
Okay. Nathan, thanks very much for that call. Let's try Michael in Rowley,
Hello.
North Carolina. Michael, welcome to Science Friday.
Can you hear me?
Yes, can.
Well, I just wanted to comment on how most of the scientific community now, at least in North Carolina, has turned towards profits and not towards science. My mother works for Research Triangle Institute, an institution that used to be incredibly well respected, huge government contracts, but now new management favors profits over, you know, scientific integrity. I was wondering if you could just comment on how the scientific community sometimes now is leaning towards profit, not towards
okay.
science.
Michael, thanks for that. I think we've found one person who's going to go out and buy your new book, Dan. That's what it sounds like. Anyway,
go ahead.
Right.
Commercialization is a very popular matter in the world of science today. Every university has a technology transfer office, has patent lawyers, and they're looking to make money from what's going on in their laboratories. And I think very interestingly, you've got delegations coming over from countries all around the world saying, show us how to do it too. That is one of the facts, bedrock facts of modern science. It's has great economic value, and people want to capture some of it for themselves or for their organization.
All right. Thanks for that call. Let's go now to Mary in Providence, Rhode Island. Mary, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
My question is this. From my perspective, I see that global warming has captured the public imagination in much the same way or even more so than the stem cell research and the promise of the medical miracle. And I'm just wondering how you see that playing out in the coming coming years, possibly the upcoming elections. And I see a lot of influence, obviously, on the younger generation in their response to environmental issues. So I'm just wondering if you see that as something that is may turn the public interest and public imagination may turn the administration around a little bit or drive electoral politics.
I think you're right. Global warming has grabbed the public imagination and has evoked enormous responses, have evoked enormous support. Al Gore has been resurrected as a national mm-hmm. figure on the global warming issue. And I think the administration, in response, finger to the wind, if I may say, has relented a bit on its hardline stand concerning measures to stop or reduce global warming. It's another one of those issues that the scientific community, I think, has exploited successfully to some extent, but scientists really are not very political. They don't organize. They don't vote as a bloc. But the issue does have a lot of glamour and interest and fear to it, and the public has latched onto it.
And why? What changed? I mean, it feels like it hadn't 4 years ago or 3 years ago or 2 years ago even, and now it has. What do you have a sense of what changed?
I think a lot of these dramatic pictures of the mountainside that was once covered with snow and now it's just, you know, plain rock has had some effect on public understanding. And then I think there's a cumulative effect year after year. Al Gore took up this issue. I remember going to hearings in the mid-70s. Nobody paid any attention at all. There was no audience. No one cared about it. Virtually no press coverage. But if you pound on it year after year, and the summers are very hot, mm-hmm. and you do see that the glaciers are melting away, I think the public at last says, hey, there may be some problem there.
Mary, thanks very much for that call.
Thank you. Thanks for the answer.
You bet. We're talking with Dan Greenberg about how politics and science sometimes get along and sometimes don't. I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take another call now. Let's go to, let's see the right number here. Greg in Spokane, Washington. Welcome to the program.
I'm glad to get through. I love your show. It's my favorite.
Great.
I'm not going to support the Bush administration and everything they do by any means, but giving them the blame for the Kyoto Protocol and for not allowing full stem cell funding isn't quite fair, because until Bush allowed it, there was no federal funding of stem cell research, and the Congress refused to ratify Kyoto, so Bush backing out of it really wasn't that much of his decision.
Oh, interesting point. Greg, what about that, Dan?
I think he's absolutely right there. There has not been any great enthusiasm in American politics or in the American economy to implement any of the Kyoto Accords or long-term goals. And also, the political sensitivity about anything with stem cells and reproductive biology, contraception and things like that, of course, long preceded George Bush. So he doesn't take the whole rap for this. It wouldn't be fair.
Yeah, it's always struck me as interesting that I don't know what would have happened if President Clinton had moved more rapidly, but he certainly instigated the notion that it might be okay for the federal government to spend research dollars on embryonic stem cells, making the distinction that embryonic stem cells weren't embryos, which that was a fight he didn't want to have. But he let things languish so that by the time they got around to funding, he was out of office. So it was actually, I think, to some degree ironic that it was President Bush, George W. Bush, who actually was the first president to fund embryonic stem cell research with federal dollars.
Well, he split the difference in sort of an interesting way, saying that the existing cell lines could be used and mm-hmm. federal funds would be available for research on them, but no more could be created. But as a matter of fact, the country is large and resilient and diverse, and a great deal of stem cell research is going on with state funds, philanthropic and foundation funds.
Mm-hmm. What about this issue about the current administration has come under a lot of heat for some of its appointment to advisory committees, where they take people with very strong ideologic positions and put them on advisory panels? For example, there was someone who was opposed to contraception on the FDA's panel that was making judgments about reproductive drugs. Is this unusual, or is this business as usual?
Well, some of the appointments really have been appalling. I mean, people who are preset and have rather prehistoric views on the uses and uses of modern science and social issues. I think actually, if you count up the number of them relative to the number of slots on the advisory committees, it turns out to be a relatively small number. I think also something that's quite important, and we haven't mentioned yet, is that Bush's appointments to head the major research agencies, such as Dr. Zahuni at NIH, for example, these have been mainstream appointments. I mean, they could just as well have been made by Bill Clinton. The people out of university background, like the head of the Undersecretary for Science at the Department of Energy, previously was the chancellor at UC Riverside. President's science advisor, John Marburger, he's probably the least influential of all the science advisors going back 50 years, but he has served longer than any of them. He says he is nominally a Democrat. And he comes out of that same mainstream background, university presidency. He once headed a big government laboratory. So those appointments haven't been too bad. But every once in a while, when an advisory position opens up, again pandering to the evangelical fundamentalist right or the business community, they'll put somebody in there who creates great outrage.
All right. Well, Dan, that's where we're going to leave it this hour. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Dan Greenberg is a science journalist. His new book is called Science for Sale: The Perils and Rewards and Delusions of Campus Capitalism. It'll be out in September from the University of Chicago Press. This program is produced by Karen Vergoth, Flora Lichtman, and senior producer Annette Heist. Charles Bergquist, Sarah Handel, and Gwen Uten are our directors. Our interns are Molly Webster and Joshua Romero. If you'd like to write to us, send us your letters at Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, Room 306, New York, New York, 10036. The email address, if you prefer that, is scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can listen to past editions of Science Friday online or take them with you as a podcast. And check out Science Friday's Kids Connection, free curriculum materials for teaching science using Science Friday. Just click on the teacher's link on sciencefriday.com. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Joe Palca.